Welcome to the HJ Talks About Abuse podcast. In this podcast, we talk about sexual abuse cases in the hope it will assist listeners in openly discussing topics which have been ignored for too long. This podcast is brought to you by the abuse team at Hugh James. We are lawyers, so we do tend to speak about the legal aspects of abuse cases, but we aren't too shy to speak up about the broader issues faced by survivors too.
Hello, podcast listeners. My name is Sam Barker. I'm from Hugh James Solicitors, and I'm joined here today by my colleague, Alan Collins.
Hello, Sam. Hello, listeners.
So today we're going to talk about limitation law reform, as this has arisen recently out of the, it's become a topic of, you know, hot debate in the Independent Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse and its Accountability and Reparations hearings. Now, many of our listeners might be aware of the Limitation Act. Basically, what that says is that you have 3 years to bring a claim against the person or indeed the organisation that is liable, or you say is liable, for what happened to you. Now, in sex abuse cases, if it happened while you're a child, you have until you are 21 years of age to bring your claim. If you are outside of that time limit, then you are, strictly speaking, out of time, and therefore you would need to apply to the court to have the time bar disapplied. And that is something that is exceedingly difficult and increasingly difficult here in the UK, as recent cases have shown. So it's widely recognised that this does, limitation laws stand as an impediment to child sexual abuse survivors in bringing a claim, even though there are, in many instances, very understandable reasons for this delay. So this is why this issue has popped its head up in these accountability and reparations hearings, because to hold somebody accountable for what's happened, you need to be able to bring a claim against them. But for many survivors, there is no avenue to do that because they are time barred. So in Scotland and Australia, for example, the time limitation in relation to sexual abuse matters has been abolished. So some would say that is a step in the right direction. And Alan, going off my kind of long-winded introduction there, you've been involved in these hearings, the accountability and reparations hearings, and what's your view on all of this?
Well, I was going to sit back and just carry on listening.
It was quite long, quite long-winded there.
Yeah, I thought, well, I haven't got anything to do. I'm going to just sit here and listen to Sam explain it all.
You are not out of, you're not out of it. So tell us about what you've been doing.
Thank you very much. I've been sitting here listening to you. That's what I've been doing. Anyway, but seriously, getting back to why we're talking about all of this today is because, as you've said, Sam, ICSRA have been looking into this and it's been taking evidence about possible reform. And a pretty firm suggestion is that for child sexual abuse cases, or generally all child abuse cases, the limitation period of 3 years ought to be dropped. So far, so good. If that is a proposal that's made by ICSRA and is taken up by government and the legislation is passed by Parliament, then yeah, you could find the three-year limitation period gone. And that would undoubtedly level the playing field as far as survivors are concerned. But moving on from that, the inquiry has been looking at what has been happening in other legal jurisdictions, for example, in Scotland and in the Australian states, which have limitation laws very similar and in many ways almost identical to the limitation laws that apply in England and Wales. But there are variations, and there's now a big difference in that Scotland and the Australian states have reformed their limitation laws. So when it comes to child abuse cases, that three-year window has gone.
So, of course, that came out of the Royal Commission into institutional responses to child sexual abuse in Australia. And over time, different jurisdictions have picked up those recommendations and abolished limitation laws on a state basis. But it is different between state to state.
Yes, but it's gone, and the devil's always in the detail. And so in Scotland, you've got a sort of proviso, a sort of exception, which is that a defendant can say to the court, well, it's all unfair, it's all happened a long time ago, we can't have a fair trial, we're prejudiced. And if a court thought that was the case, then it could stay the proceedings. In other words, basically kick the case out.
So it's an abusive process exception to the limitation laws being abolished altogether.
There's always been this sort of abusive process argument, but what the legislation, for example, in Scotland does, in my opinion, is put in black and white this sort of proviso. And what I'm saying is the devil is in the detail, and what you don't want to have is limitation creeping in by the back door. So, you know, you think you've abolished limitation for child abuse cases, and then you find in the small print limitation all over again.
But in the Scottish legislation, where there's these fairness provisions in Scotland, they refer to a claimant as the pursuer, and then there's the defender. So the defender would need to successfully argue that either a fair trial is impossible or there is substantial prejudice to the defender outweighing the interests of the pursuer. At the very least, that's good because it passes the burden of establishing whether a fair trial's possible or impossible to the defence.
Well, that's right. And the current position is that the claimant, the plaintiff, the pursuer in England and Wales has to establish basically that a fair trial is still possible.
The burden
is on him or her. Mm. Whereas under this legislation, the burden shifts to the defendant. So that is a big, major, substantial difference, and it's an important one.
It is, yeah.
So we need to see how all this sort of works in practice. And there's been a couple of cases in Australia where similar provisions have been considered and applied. But starting off with Scotland, there's recently been a case called LM versus the executor of DG, which is where the survivor, the pursuer, brought a claim against the stepfather's estate. The allegation was that the stepfather had been abusive. The stepfather was arrested by the police, interviewed, denied matters or made no comment on the advice of the lawyer who was present at the interview, and then died quite quickly afterwards. So that's why the claim is brought against the estate. And the estate, as I understand it, was arguing, well, it's all unfair. You know, the alleged abuser, you know, the deceased is dead and we don't know what he would say about matters.
Although, yeah,
of course, at the police station, he denied matters, so he did have something to say about it. But of course, he's not around to be questioned, cross-examined. And so it's a classic situation of the estate saying, oh, well, you know, it all happened a long while ago and the alleged abuser is dead and can't be called for obvious reasons to give evidence. And so we, the estate, are prejudiced. So the court had to consider these arguments under the new law that applies in Scotland. And the judge, a sheriff, in this particular case, didn't chuck the case out there and then, because he was of the opinion that a trial was still possible because the survivor, the claimant, pursuer, was available to be questioned and be cross-examined, as would any other witnesses. And, of course, there was the police interview, which provided a window to look through to see what the deceased would have had to say about matters. But
it's quite an important point, isn't it,
yeah,
that this police interview transcript was available where he denied all matters. It's something that's raised often in England in abuse cases where the deceased is dead, a fair trial just cannot be possible because they're not there to be, you know, give evidence, be cross-examined, etc. But, you know, so much of that should fall away when the abuser, the alleged abuser, has denied everything at a police interview in the first place. You know, why would they come to a civil trial and say something completely different?
That's right. So, you know, as I said, the police interview provides ample scope in many cases for a court to form a decision as to what the accused would say about matters if they appeared in the courtroom and actually gave evidence about matters. And of course, sometimes they choose not to. But working on the basis that they did, well, you know, the police interview provides a pretty good idea.
It's interesting looking at these cases how, you know, the thinking and jurisprudence on these issues shift in that in England, when we're dealing with limitation cases, there's always this tendency to say you can't put the cart before the horse. You can't hear the evidence and then make a decision on limitation. You've got to make a decision on limitation under the relevant provisions of the Limitation Act and the exceptions. Whereas in this case here, the claimant argued that the question of fairness could only be determined after the court had heard all the available evidence.
That's right.
And perhaps that's because of the burden of where of who has to establish whether the fair trial is possible or impossible.
Yeah, and every case, of course, is different in terms of on its own particular facts, which is recognised in this case and in the Australian cases.
Yeah,
but thinking
that's right.
Back 20, 30 years when I first started out in practice, the judicial mindset and approach would be completely different to what it is now. So judges would have raised their judicial eyebrows at these sorts of cases, you know, and would be saying, well, what's this case doing in my court? It all happened a long time ago. And they would see it as an abusive process. So thinking is far more sophisticated and nuanced.
Yeah, look into the issues
compared
deeper, you know.
To 20, 30 years ago.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting that the sheriff was very much alive to the Australian cases. And actually, one reads the judgment, made the point to the advocates that they needed to go away and look at the Australian cases.
They're already dealing with this issue
a lot.
That's right.
So the sheriff referred to a New South Wales case called Judd versus McKnight, where again the defendant was trying to argue that the case ought to be chucked out because the alleged perpetrator was dead, but the court wouldn't do so because the alleged perpetrator had made admissions whilst alive, albeit denied that any sexual offences had been committed, but clearly the court thought there was enough there to allow the case to proceed. And the sheriff thought that the case that he was dealing with was not dissimilar to that of Judd. And of course that contrasts, doesn't it, with that other case of Connellan versus Murphy, which is a Victoria case,
Supreme
Court case, where the perpetrator was alive, but the court clearly felt that a fair trial was no longer possible because other witnesses, which could be determinative of which way the case was went, was no longer available, and there was big evidential issues in relation to causation and quantum.
Yeah, so in that case, there was a stay that meant that on the basis of an abusive process and the case couldn't proceed. But from my understanding of the case law that exists, that's the only one so far where that has been successfully argued, following on from the abolition of limitation laws.
Yeah.
And it does show, doesn't it? But thinking out loud, it is proper and it is appropriate, is it not, to have that kind of backup for any kind of case, because there has to be some sort of check on fairness and fairness to both sides and all of that.
Well, there's always the inherent jurisdiction, and the judge can always say, I'm satisfied that the case has not been proved.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced myself that you need to have enshrined in statute these provisos. I think they're just adding an unnecessary potential complication, because the judge could say, I've heard the evidence and I'm not satisfied that the claimant or the plaintiff have proved their case.
So you think it should just come down to the judge's assessment on balance?
Yeah. Without having this
cases should proceed.
Potential fiction of trying to determine, can there be a fair trial? Because that's, you know, you're just sort of saying, well, it's limitation all over again in but name.
Yeah, indeed. And we're talking about just child sexual abuse cases here.
Yes, that's right. We're not talking about road traffic accidents or clinical negligence or industrial disease. We're talking about child abuse cases only.
Well, they're developing obviously a substantial body of case law already in respect of vicarious liability and negligence and all of those causes of action. And we can see here in states where limitation has been abolished, there's further bodies of case law being established. And in Australia, I know now that in certain states when you can undo settlement agreements, which is completely contrary to the finality of litigation and principles like that that have existed in law forever, in the context of child sexual abuse cases, there's a new body of law that's going to be created there. I think that just recently there's been a decision that undid a previous settlement agreement because it was settled because of limitation issues that would be non-existent now. So it's interesting to see how it's all developing.
It is, and it sort of flies against the principle of certainty.
Indeed, yeah.
And that's often what, you know, underpins limitation law. Its limitation is to ensure that there aren't stale cases and that cases are dealt with quickly and so that everyone has a degree of certainty.
And it's so different with child sexual abuse cases than commercial cases, for example, because, you know, in commercial cases, you can understand why there's no scope to extend. If people didn't just get their act together to bring the case, on the basis of what they knew at the time, and then they're out of time, say 6 years later. People have to know that they're not going to be sued. People have to be able to, you know, plan, or businesses need to be able to do that. But in child sexual abuse cases, the delay is completely understandable because of what's inherent in these kind of crimes, that, you know, you have this delayed onset, you have 20 years later, people only then get coming to terms with what happened to them, or being able to tell people in their wider circle or the police. So, you know, it's good to see the law, at least finally, it's in some places, catching up to that way of thinking.
Well, indeed, but if you think about these recent cases and recent English cases where the court has had to consider the Limitation Act, where cases succeed or fail, it actually all comes down to one thing. Is the judge, the court, satisfied that the claimant stroke plaintiff has proved his or her case?
It's all about the cogency of the evidence.
It's all about the cogency of the evidence.
That's all it comes down to.
This 3-year business is a little bit of a red herring. It's all about the cogency of the evidence. Has the claimant, stroke plaintiff, been able to prove his or her case? That's what it's all about.
Yeah, it's interesting to say that, actually, because when you think about it, 3 years or 6 years for certain people, or 10 years, some people have far better recall or are able to remember events with a lot more clarity than others. Is it really, you know, the difference between 3 or 4 years that affects that cogency?
I think if the judge is satisfied, is confident that the claimant has proved his or her case, there's a way through.
Yeah,
and so you don't need, in my experience or opinion, these sort of provisos on prejudice, fair trial, because it all amounts to the same thing at the end of the day. Is the court satisfied that this happened or not? If the judge isn't satisfied, then the case is going to fail anyway.
Yeah, it's a central issue. And what do you think coming out of all of this? Obviously, there's this interesting case law in Australia, in Scotland as well, which appears to be following some of that case law in Australia. What's the inquiry going to do with all of this?
I think the inquiry will recommend that the Limitation Act be reformed for child abuse cases. What I'm hoping is that if Parliament takes it up, which it ought to, because it'll be an inquiry recommendation, that it doesn't blur the edges by adding bits and pieces because defendants say, oh, well, it's all unfair, because the checks and balances are there anyway.
Mm. It's interesting if they reverse the burden here like they did in Scotland. You could effectively be using all the same precedent anyway, couldn't you? The cases in the last 10 years are all about prejudice and fairness. Does it change anything in that regard?
Well, that's why I say if you condense it down to the basics, it is the court satisfied that the allegations are true?
And can it be satisfied of that?
Yes. If not, the judge will dismiss the case.
Well, I think we've bitten each other's ear off for a while now on this, and
thank you,
the podcast listeners. So thank you for listening. And I'm sure that once there is an outcome, or that the inquiry recommends one way or the other, we'll be doing an update.
Thank you very much. Bye, listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of HJ Talks About Abuse. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you would like to speak to Alan or I about something you have heard this week, or even if you would like to suggest a topic for a future episode, please do get in touch at aboutabuse@hjtalks.co.uk.